If you meant to be somewhere else, this is session 401, the potential for Web 2.0 for collection development. I'm Jessica Locker Feldman. I'm the curator of rare books and special collections at the Houle Special Collections Library at the University of Alabama. And we have three speakers. One of them is not here, so I'm going to be channeling her. Lynn Thomas, who's the head of rare books and special collections at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb. And she's responsible for popular cultural special collections that include the papers of 33 science fiction and fantasy authors. And we're going to talk a little bit about that today. Our other speakers include, to my immediate right, Laura Eugleen Jackson. She's the Assistant Archivist and Processing Department for the American Heritage Center, which is featured on the screen there, but not blue, at the University of Wyoming. In addition to her processing duties, she's the university archivist responsible for the records management program, and she joined the AHC in July 2007 to work on a reappraisal and deaccessioning project, which she presented on at last year's meeting in San Francisco. She's active in the Wyoming Library Association's Academic and Special Collections section, SAA's Records Management Roundtable, and Acquisition and Appraisal section. She's originally from Colorado and has a BA in Art History from Colorado State University and an MLIS from Simmons. And then to my further right is Amy Schindler. She's the University Archivist at Special Collections Research Center at the Earl Gregg Swem Library at the College of William and Mary, and she oversees the records of the second oldest institution of higher education in the U.S. and serves as the university's records officer. In addition to activities typical to this position, she's active in the department's access and outreach activities, including leading the department's social media 2.0 efforts, as well as participating in the library and university efforts of 2.0 activities. You'll find Special Collections Department on Twitter, Flickr, and YouTube at SWEMSCRC. She has an MLS and an MA from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and a BA in History and Certificate of Asian American Studies from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's done a lot of stuff. She's very active in the RAO section of SAA. She was at the curator of manuscripts at SUNY Albany, yay, and held a short-term position at Northwestern Mutual Life, Harley-Davidson, and the City of Schenectady. So I now am going to give Lynn's paper. So I wanted to have something fun up on the screen, but we will all, this is pretty fun. I'm going to sit. And I know this is sort of the kiss of death, but I think that I'm a relatively animated person, so you'll have to bear with me. And it's a very good paper. Can everybody hear me? No? All right. Now can everybody hear me? Better? Okay. Sip of water. And this is weird because I am not Lynn M. Thomas, but we both have bachelor's degree in French. Bachelor's degree is in French, and we both have the same title, so pretend. Okay. Good morning. I would like to begin by expressing my deep thanks to Jessica Locker Feldman for her willingness to read this paper in my absence when I became unable to attend the conference in person. Please accept my deepest apologies for my lack of physical presence in real life, or IRL. I hope that this paper will give you some pragmatic ideas for conducting donor relations virtually in a Web 2.0 environment. The experience of assembling this panel is very much in keeping with the theme. I've never met any of my fellow panelists in person, and she still hasn't, but many of us are now Facebook friends after putting the session together. I'm hoping that we can manage to meet in person sometime, but in the meantime, it serves as a great example of how social networking in a Web 2.0 environment lends itself to library and archival activities, particularly when working with a particular user community that you have targeted. This panel targets librarians and archivists, and I will be speaking, I will be speaking later, about targeting the other donor communities. This is weird, you guys. I was asked to be a presenter on this panel because of a colleague and fellow blogger, we all know, Kate Timer of the Archives Next blog, noted the topic proposal, and I thought I might have some suggestions as to topics, examples of 2.0 donor relations and possible speakers. I was working on my book, Special Collections 2.0, at the time, and blogging and Twittering about it rather incessantly. That book, co-authored by Beth Whitaker, was published by Libraries Unlimited in July. Kate put me in touch with Tara, and I sent Tara a list of ideas. One of them piqued her interest for the panel, and I was asked to present upon it as a panelist. I learned two specific lessons from the particular from this particular Web 2.0 experience. Lesson number one, Web 2.0 is all about do-it-yourself. And if you come up with ideas for using 2.0 tools, you will likely be implementing them yourself. Lesson 1A, be especially aware of this if you are the sort of person who tends to think out loud, as I am, or as she is, and as I am. Anyway, thinking out loud, I'm sorry, this is funny. Thinking out loud on my blog is what prompted the book proposal and eventually the invitation to participate in this panel. Doing it yourself takes time. The bulk of tools out there for social networking, sharing pictures and video, and blogging are specifically designed to be relatively easy to use. But there is still a bit of a learning curve. Recognize it and plan for it. You will need to spend some time skimming the web to find cheat sheets and tips, particularly as you wish to move past the more basic functionality of most sites. The bulk of these Web 2.0 applications are hosted on remote servers and don't require downloading or local system support, but it's also a very good idea to check with your systems folks if you are planning to do this, thus keeping them in the loop. Lesson number two, my online presence. How I represent myself on my blogs, on Twitter, on listservs, and social networking sites directly shapes the public perception of me as a person and as a professional, and can lead to specific real-life consequences. This is nothing particularly new. For those of us who have been subject to previous website redesigns for rebranding or arguments on closed library discussion listservs have seen this sort of thing before. The difference now is that the community of users that access your self-representation is much larger and more active than it used to be. Web 2.0 users are not passive consumers of information. They are active participants in its creation, expecting the ability to tag, comment, reply, link, and forward at will. It is the act of interacting that keeps our users interested in our message, our materials, and our sites. Users may be drinking from the equivalent of a fire hose of information, but they are practiced at taking small sips and recommending particular hydrants and methods of sipping to their friends. In other words, people are far more likely to retweet something that you say on Twitter, share on Facebook, or post to your blog or Flickr account with a single click than they are to forward an email from a listserv, because all of those actions are built into their information streams as default options, requiring much less effort. Users connected to a person doing the forwarding are far more likely to trust that source as verifiable or real or honest because it comes through someone that they actually know or feel that they know. Connecting through friends of friends and colleagues of colleagues happens much more quickly and further afield than it used to when we were strictly working solely with one-way communication for websites and two-way communication through email, phone calls, or face-to-face discussions at conferences. While these methods of communication and networking have not gone away, they are now routinely augmented by social networking technologies. According to the survey that we completed while writing Special Collections 2.0, cultural heritage professionals already Twitter consistently at conferences, post status updates about events and exhibitions on Facebook, and blog about collections they are processing using Blogger, WordPress, and LiveJournal, often posting images and videos about these materials to Flickr or YouTube. When we return to our home institutions from these conferences, we are friending each other as a way of staying in touch and continuing the conversation. These online conversations are already well underway. The question is whether or not you or your institution wish to join in or create new conversations with colleagues, potential users, and donors, and if so, how do you go about doing so in a way that will keep everyone sane and satisfied with the results? Let me be clear. I am not advocating that cultural heritage institutions go out and create a shadow presence on every social networking or Web 2.0 content sharing site and devote thousands of hours to monitoring them, to the detriment of our existing backlogs. I am merely suggesting that these technologies deserve some consideration as to their usefulness to our professional and institutional lives, both as cultural artifacts and as tools in our public relations arsenal. As cultural memory organizations, we will ultimately be responsible for documenting them as part of the cultural record. Cultural heritage institutions do selection and appraisal as a matter of course. These texts, communities, and online documents in our cultural heritage are worthy of undergoing the selection and appraisal process as any other cultural document. They should not be excluded from our processes merely because of their original format. The best way to understand the underlying structure of these formats, which will help us document them, is to gain some firsthand knowledge of how they work by using them. However, I do think it's important to recognize that not participating in these sites and communities is itself a choice which has institutional consequences. It may sound rather Machiavellian, but keep in mind that choosing not to participate in these communities in some manner may also lead to judgments about your library or archive as an organization. Users may assume a lack of interest, initiative, or technological savvy on the part of libraries and archives that do not have some sort of socially networked representation on the wider web outside of their institutional websites, assuming that they know of your existence at all. As Cory Doctorow has said, the problem is not privacy, it's obscurity. While we may be content to toil in obscurity for a while, it is far easier to advocate for continued institutional funding when we can demonstrate the existence of a large user community that cares about the institution. These technologies present another way to build our institutional visibility, another way to tell our story, which is central to retaining and growing internal and external financial support for our programs. To be blunt, the more publicly visible we are, the more likely it is that we can sustain reasonable budgets, because when cuts occur, there is a public outcry. A recent example of this is the Twitter and other social media campaign that helped restore a massive funding cut for Ohio's public libraries. From theory to practice, lessons learned. As a curator of rare books and special collections, I do selection, appraisal, acquisitions, public relations, and collection development as part of my job. In the past 2 years, I have found these tools to be extremely useful in my daily work. I should state for the record that my experience has mostly been with working with contemporary collections, that is, working with authors, publishers, editors, and fans of science fiction and fantasy literature, which is one of our collecting focuses at Northern Illinois University. These, then, are the lessons that I've learned thus far in becoming a socially networked curator as a method of building my donor base. Lesson one, Web 2.0 is not just a fly-by-night trend that can be ignored. These Web 2.0 tools are quite well established. Blogging has been around for 15 years. Facebook and MySpace have been around for over 5 years each. And Flickr, YouTube, and Twitter are a few years old. These are, by cutting-edge technology standards, no longer new technologies. They are part of the information stream of everyday life for millions of people. Their popularity helps to ensure their continuation in some manner for the time being. If part of our charge as cultural heritage professionals is to reach out to our users, how effective are we, really, in doing so if we aren't making our materials discoverable in the places where the largest number of potential users are most likely to be? Lesson number two, be interesting, briefly and consistently. Being interesting, quirky, and different, along with pictures of cute kittens, well, I would say cute puppies, drives popularity and traffic on the social web. Luckily, cultural heritage professionals are often responsible for some of the most interesting, quirky, and different historical materials out there. Those of you that work on the front lines in archives know about the popularity of genealogical research and amateur enthusiast historians in particular subject areas. The popularity of these materials is just as visible on the social web. If the reactions to projects like Photos Normandy and the Library of Congress Flickr comments have been any indication, content drives traffic. We should leverage our content as much as we possibly can, or our collections may be destined to be hidden no matter how well we use traditional methods to describe them. One of the advantages of many of the social web tools is that they are designed for brevity. Facebook status updates, Twitter tweets, and blog posts work very well for the exposure of collection items that we don't need to say much more than, "Look at this, isn't it neat?" The onus is then on the intrigued users to comment, share, or follow that item of interest back to us, our services, and our deep, wonderful collections. Users have a good experience using our materials remotely, are more likely to think kindly of us in general, and to provide positive word of mouth to their online friends. A key detail that must be understood when using these tools, however, is that it must be some sort of effort expended to be consistently post, because consistent content is how you remain viable and maintain the attention of your users. The quickest way to kill your social networking profile, Twitter account, or blog is to set it up and never post any content. Also, pictures, whenever possible, are generally preferable to text alone. Lesson three, you don't have to do everything, but it's good to try something. Choose wisely. There are 24 hours in the day only, and even librarians and archivists need to sleep sometime. There's no need to have a presence on every platform. In fact, it's far better to examine several options, just pick one or two, and focus based on your goals for the platform. You should have some of those, too. If you want to showcase your historical photograph collections, then it makes more sense to open a Flickr account than to post them one by one to Twitter. If your goal is to publicize your friends group, perhaps an active Facebook page that sends your users event reminders may be the best use of your time. It's far better to have a really good blog and an active Facebook page, but no Twitter or Flickr account, than to have it all going at once, none of which gain new content because there just isn't time. Lesson number 4, do what you say, say what you do. The most popular sites are consistent in their policies and practices. It's a good idea to make policies about posting, comments, or whom you will or will not friend or follow public. State your goals and your aims, then follow through. There is no rule that says all blogs and Twitter accounts must be high traffic. I subscribe to plenty of blogs that only post once or twice a month and Twitter streams that only post a few tweets per day. I still follow them because what they do post, however sporadically, is interesting, thoughtful, and worth reading, thus worth waiting for. The key is to set user expectations ahead of time rather than managing them after the fact. Lesson number 4. Or 5. This should be authentic. This should be stating. This shouldn't need stating, but I'm going to begin with a public service announcement for those who have never been on the internet before. If you wouldn't stand by those words in public, don't post them on the internet. Assume that everything that you say is public. You never know who will be reading what you say, but you can be sure at some point someone will disagree with you. Accept disagreement with grace and move on. Don't waste your energies on internet slap fights. You have far better things to do with your time. There are different ways to interact and use these tools. The key is to sit down and think about what you as a user, a person, and a professional are comfortable with and design your social networking presence to coincide with that. If you're not someone that relishes the idea of being a public figure, it is perfectly acceptable to let your institutional profile do the talking. If you're comfortable with being a public figure, be sure to keep track of your profile and manage it carefully. Scrub your wall, basically. There are plenty of cultural professionals that want to keep their work and private life separate and do so by using one platform such as LinkedIn for professional use and one such as Facebook for personal use. Many of us maintain multiple profiles on a single service like Twitter so that we don't have to mix following our favorite celebrities, baseball teams, or hobbies with our professional conversations. It's also quite easy to maintain single profiles but participate in separate conversations that need not mix. All of these platforms have privacy settings and ways to organize disparate communities. As a result, it's rather easy to restrict family photos to family members only on Facebook while letting your professional colleagues see the pictures of you from SAA. Ultimately, you are responsible for deciding how to represent yourself online and how much of your time you'd like to share. It's a deeply personal decision each of you must make individually. Just know that whatever level of self-disclosure that in this setting you choose, there are tools available to manage it. In my case, I've chosen to self-disclose a bit more than others may have done for a distinctly professional reason. As a curator that works very closely with current writing authors in the SF or science fiction community, I'm asking for them to donate their papers and archives. For this community, it's a matter of trust, and the decision to donate to my university is not often a matter of whether or not they trust. It is often a matter of whether or not they trust me. Although there are a few large science fiction archives for whom this is not an issue, there's a long history of curators that have begun to build small science fiction collections at smaller institutions, and once leadership changed, so did the direction of the archive, abandoning a handful of writers to a remote location. The authors that I work with want to be reassured that this won't happen to their materials. When they meet me and talk to me, they are interested in getting to know me, and one of the ways that they do that is by reading my blogs, looking at my Facebook profile, seeing what I'm reading on Goodreads, and subscribing to my Twitter stream. What they learn is that I'm a relatively new but active member of their community with interest in both published science fiction literature and media fandom. I don't post anything that isn't true. I do choose to highlight those facets of my work and personal life that are most relevant to their interests in a way of demonstrating that I am indeed part of their community. We use these tools to continue building a relationship online that began in person. Rather than having lots of phone calls or emails back and forth and spending a lot of money for travel, we play Scrabble on Facebook. We forward links to one another on Twitter. I become part of their daily casual information stream, easily accessible to answer questions. I become, in essence, their personal archivist or librarian, answering reference questions relating to stories that they're writing. If a protagonist was to steal a book, would this work in real life? Where are the underground rivers in northern Illinois? As well as functional questions about placing things in our archives. Do you prefer RTF or Word documents? Do you want copy-edited manuscripts? Galley proofs? Review copies? This information stream also helps me keep track of things like when it's a good time to contact someone about their archival materials and when it's not. When writers are under deadline, they say so publicly. I comment on their blogs and they comment on mine. I opened a LiveJournal account just for this purpose, which has since become my personal blog. Although I've maintained Confessions of a Curator in my professional blog for over 2 years, when I talk about library-related issues, this is what it's like to be a curator and muse about things like the Google Book settlement. Most of the authors that I'm working with consistently follow me on LiveJournal and don't interact with my Confessions of a Curator at all. The authors are far more interested in getting to know me as a person than as a librarian/archivist. My personal LiveJournal blog is much more about my personal life. I use it to blog about my family for relatives that live in other parts of the country, for instance, and to talk with fans of the same television series that I watch. It is nonetheless designed for public consumption. I do not use it as an actual online personal journal. I assume that anything that I post there is public and act accordingly. This means that on occasion I do self-censor. If I read a book and didn't enjoy it, the negative review is unlikely to end up on my live journal because you never know when the author might see it, particularly if they are later approached for archiving. Hey, just because it's not my cup of tea as a reader doesn't mean it's not worth documenting. Praise, however, for books that I enjoyed is always publicly shared. I've never known an author to be angry about a positive review. Lesson 5. Assess, regroup, and sometimes change or let go. Of course, the biggest question we all have is whether learning of this new technology is worth our time. In my case, the answer is a resounding yes. When I started approaching science fiction authors about their papers, I had not a single piece of archival material in hand. Two authors donated papers after meeting me in person at conventions. 2 years later, I have materials from 33 authors in hand. About 20% of these authors have not actually met me in real life, but know me by reputation, based on my online social networking, and the fact that their friends know me. Using these tools, my network has gotten much bigger, much faster than it might have if I had been doing all of my networking in person or over the phone. That's only one assessment, however. Since I began doing this, I have made some adjustments to my online work manageable. To make my online work manageable, I use services such as Google Analytics, Technorati, and FeedBurner to periodically assess my professional blog. As a result, its focus has shifted based on my understanding of my actual readership as opposed to whom I thought might be likely readers. I try to schedule time every week to write blog entries. If I have a good chunk of time, I will write more than one entry and then schedule them to post on different days, keeping content flowing. I do routinely check Facebook, Twitter, and LiveJournal throughout the day. These are some of the services that I use most heavily. I make a point of noticing when links get responses, when comments get forwarded and shared, which status updates and blog entries get the most traffic or generate the most commentary, both online and offline, and gear my blog entries, status updates, and tweets towards those topics. Since I have chosen to do my outreach using these methods with my institution's blessing, I've also made sure to note my social networking activities and their successes in my departmental annual reports and in my tenure file annual reports to continue demonstrating their utility to my work. I've learned that it's okay to let go. I don't really have to be present in every community, in every conversation. I've tried some services and let them lapse because they don't fit my workflow well enough to continue using them. My friend feed and LinkedIn accounts are basically placeholders that were created for test driving them for our book. My department does not yet have a Flickr stream or a YouTube channel, but you can pry my delicious account out of my cold, dead hands. I also try to purposely build on non-internet time in my schedule so that I have sustained time for thought and writing that isn't tied to these services. It's very easy to get lost in this stream of short, pithy words if you allow it to happen. Each of us must set our boundaries for such things. In conclusion, what I'd like you to take away from this session is that just because social networking can be fun, it doesn't mean it isn't work. and just because it's work doesn't mean it can't be fun. If beating you online at Scrabble is what it takes to convince a donor that you're the right institution to host their legacy, who are we to argue? Thank you. Thanks for your patience in reading. Usually I like to...
Okay, can you hear me okay? Wait. How about here? Okay. Well, I'm going to switch gears a little bit and talk about actually collecting the Web 2.0 sites. These days, it seems that everyone is creating some sort of record using Web 2.0 technology. Iranian citizens relied on Twitter to send and receive information about the protests after their 2009 presidential election. All of the major U.S. presidential candidates used Facebook as part of their campaign strategies. And, as evidenced in many SAA sessions this year, archivists are using various Web 2.0 technologies to connect with patrons and donors. Records of historical and institutional importance are increasingly being created online with Web 2.0 technologies. In the same way that libraries and archives have collected non-Web 2.0 sites, Web 2.0 applications such as blogs, wikis, social networking, and media sharing sites can enhance collecting areas and specific collections. This is particularly true when developing a topical or event-based collection, which has been the trend with website collections. Web 2.0 technologies allow anybody with an internet connection to contribute to an online social memory, providing archives with the potential to collect a networked body of content about an event, topic, or person. This paper will discuss my experience with trying to collect this memory for the Matthew Shepard Web Archive. It will include an overview of the Web 2.0 sites that we tried to collect. As you will hear, many difficulties were encountered in trying to collect these sites. The Living Web Archives, a consortium dedicated to developing more advanced tools for website capture and preservation, states on their website that capturing social websites is an extreme challenge and cannot be fully achieved through current methods and tools. Not only were there problems with capture and access, but there were also general archival issues with appraisal, authenticity, copyright, and collecting active records, and each of these topics will be discussed at the end of the presentation. In order to better understand the reasoning for the creation of the collection, I want to begin by giving some background information on Matthew Shepard's murder and its impact on society. Matthew Shepard was a gay student at the University of Wyoming, which is located in Laramie, a town of about 27,000 people. On the night of October 6, 1998, Shepard left the Laramie bar with two men, Russell Henderson and Aaron McKinney. They drove Shepard to a field outside of Laramie, where they tied him to a fence and severely beat him. They drove away and left Shepard in the cold and windy Wyoming night. Approximately 18 hours later, a bicyclist rode by and found Shepard barely alive. He was rushed to a hospital in Fort Collins, Colorado, where he laid in a coma for 5 days and eventually died on October 12, 1998. Henderson and McKinney were arrested for his murder. The following year, both Henderson and McKinney were found guilty, and both were sentenced to 2 life terms in prison. Matthew Shepard's murder affected both the local and national population to a great extent. Locally, Laramie residents worked hard to reverse the message that Laramie was a place of intolerance and hate. Candlelight vigils, rallies, and protests were immediately organized, including a march in the homecoming parade protesting the hate crime, which took place while Shepard was still in a coma. Fred Phelps and the Westboro Baptist Church, a group that regularly demonstrates at funerals, religious functions, and other events, came to Wyoming. They first protested at Shepard's funeral and then returned for the trials. When they returned, a group of individuals from Wyoming and Colorado staged a silent counter-protest by wearing enormous angel wings to try and block Phelps and his group. It was the first time that the Westboro Baptist Church was met with such a protest, and similar angel protests still take place today. Laramie also became center stage for a national media frenzy, with the murder and trials covered extensively in the news. The debate over a federal hate crime law was reinvigorated, and the Matthew Shepard Act was introduced to Congress. A law designed to protect those attacked because of their sexual orientation, both houses of Congress recently passed the act after first being introduced 10 years ago. The murder and the aftermath sparked the creation of several movies, documentaries, songs, and books, many which were created by people who did not personally know Shepherd. His parents, Judy and Dennis Shepherd, founded the Matthew Shepherd Foundation, an organization dedicated to erasing hate in our society, putting gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender, or GLBT youth first, and ensuring equality for all GLBT Americans. The foundation's website reads, "The life and death of Matthew Shepherd changed the way we talk about and deal with hate in the United States." Clearly, Shepherd's murder and the subsequent social impact was something that needed to be documented. Immediately after Shepherd's attack, the American Heritage Center began collecting materials. The result was an artificial collection of newspaper clippings, posters, banners, videotapes, correspondence, and ephemera. As the years passed, we continued to add new material to the Matthew Shepherd collection, including web pages printed on paper. The physical collection contains about 20 folders of printed websites dated from 1998 to 2000. While websites printed on acid-free paper certainly provide evidence of their existence, show the general layout of the site, and will preserve for hundreds of years without an archivist's help, elements such as user interaction, look and feel, audio, moving images, links to other relevant sites, and any later changes are not preserved. It was apparent that if we did not do something to preserve these sites in a web environment, then they would be lost. Throughout the 10 years since Shepherd's murder, people have been and still are creating material that aligns with our collecting objectives to document the murder and its impact in society. However, little of the new material exists in paper or physical format. Instead, much of this information is born online, and the most current material exists on Web 2.0 platforms such as Facebook, MySpace, Flickr, YouTube, and blogs. Older websites, such as the Matthew Shepherd Foundation's, still exist and are updated regularly, but now the Foundation's website links to an official Facebook page, which is only one among many other Facebook pages related to Matthew Shepherd. In order to document the websites to the best of our ability, we created the Matthew Shepherd Web Archive using the subscription-based service Archive-It. For those of you not familiar with Archive-It, it's an offshoot of the Internet Archive that crawls, harvests, hosts, and provides an access interface for websites that you, the archivist, select. This image on the screen is the standard interface. In-house IT support is not required. Learning how to use the online program takes about an hour, and programming your crawls is fairly simple. Once the websites are captured, you can describe them using Dublin Core and create your own personalized website from which users can then access the archived sites. However, the service does come with a fee, and it is significant when compared to the other option of using free open source software, such as the Web Curators tool. So with a grant from the University of Wyoming's President's Advisory Council on Minorities and Women's Affairs, we were able to purchase a subscription, allowing us to collect 150 websites and 2.5 million documents. A document can be an entire web page or a component of a web page, such as a TIFF or PDF file. Using Archive-It was the best choice for us because at the time, we did not have the technical expertise or storage capabilities necessary to properly and efficiently collect web content. Currently, over 95 other institutions have used Archive-It to create website collections. Our subscription was for a month-long period in October 2008, which marked 10 years since Shepherd's death. After an over-the-phone training session, we were ready to begin, and I started by identifying sites for capture. Thanks to Google, searching for and finding sites was an easy process. I found several within seconds time, including memorial web pages and pages for the books, films, and TV movies about Shepherd. And these were all included in our harvest. 2 weeks into the subscription period, we still had room available to capture about 100 more websites and nearly 1 million documents. In an attempt to use all of our subscription space, I decided to search the social networking sites such as Facebook and MySpace and media sharing sites such as YouTube and Flickr. Lo and behold, there was content related to Matthew Shepherd on all of these sites. At the time, Facebook had about 10 sites directly related to Matthew Shepherd. As of last month, there were more than 20. All of them are fairly similar. They are memorials created by individuals, organizations, and student groups. Unfortunately, because one needs a login and password to view most of the content on Facebook, the pages could not be captured. Much of the content on Facebook is not public, and neither archive its crawler, which is called Heritrix, and it's the same one used by the web curators tool, nor can any other website crawler capture social networking sites unless they are publicly available. Of course, one simple solution could be to request that the page be made public during the crawl. However, a couple of Facebook pages that I thought were publicly available still could not be captured due to a previous glitch with Archive-It's Wayback Machine, which is the tool that allows users to view the archive websites. The sites you see in the slide are what users see when they try to access the Facebook pages through the Wayback Machine. Because Archive-It is working to better collect social media and Web 2.0, they now have special instructions to avoid this problem, as well as a guide for collecting Twitter, Flickr, and YouTube content. MySpace had several sites dedicated to Matthew Shepard as well, and we were able to collect one of the pages, which you can see here. Most of the MySpace pages looked similar to this one, and I will discuss this more when I talk about appraisal. YouTube had dozens of videos related to Matthew Shepard. However, we were only able to capture two of them because we had technical problems with our initial capture and because most of the videos were compilations of scenes from TV movies. One of the videos we captured was of singer-songwriter Randy Driscoll playing the song she wrote in memory of Matthew Shepard, and the other was a trailer for a documentary called Journey to a Hate-Free Millennium, which educates students about hate crimes in America, and a significant portion is about Matthew Shepard. Currently, you can view the videos in the archive, but they are separate from the actual YouTube pages, and contextual information could not be captured alongside the videos. The YouTube pages are hardly recognizable, and they look like the image to your right when accessed in the Wayback Machine. We also captured a couple of blogs, which was easy because blogs are, for the most part, available to the public. Several individuals and organizations were blogging about the 10-year mark since Shepard's death, including a UW staff member who was a friend of Shepard's and a group called the Feminist Law Professors. These blogs were not dedicated exclusively to Matthew Shepard, and I did not want to capture them in their entirety. Unfortunately, I ended up accidentally capturing much more of the Feminist Law Professor's blog than I really wanted to, resulting in several thousand documents lost to unwanted content. This was a lesson to run a test crawl or put limits on the number of documents to collect before crawling a blog, because it is not possible to remove websites from the Archive-It collection. Flickr had a couple of photographs related to Matthew Shepard, which we were able to collect, and I will explain more about these when I discuss appraisal and authenticity. We did not capture any Twitter content because in October of last year, there was nothing related to Matthew Shepard on Twitter. As of 3 weeks ago, there were two Twitter pages devoted to Matthew Shepard, including the Matthew Shepard Foundation's official Twitter page, which we would have captured had it been available last October. On that note, according to both Archive-It and the Joint Information Systems Committee's Preservation of Web Resources, or the JISC Power Team, Twitter pages are publicly available by default and can be captured quite easily. In addition to the technical problems encountered with collecting these sites, for which, by the way, Archive-It provided great technical support, there were a few general archival issues that came up in regard to appraising and acquiring Web 2.0 content. I would like to discuss the following four topics for the remainder of the presentation. One, determining the value of the sites. Two, authenticity. Three, the issue of copyright. And four, the issue of collecting active records. Before I begin, I would like to express my feeling that these are complex issues and require further discussion than what I can fit in the remaining portion of this presentation. So let's begin with the issue of appraisal, or determining if these sites have any value for our purposes, which were to document the murder, the issues surrounding it, and its impact 10 years later. Creating a page, posting a comment, linking to other sites, and embedding videos in a Web 2.0 environment takes hardly any time at all. Often, someone will reuse content that exists elsewhere on the web. This ease and efficiency for the end user is what has made Web 2.0 platforms popular. However, it has also attracted critics who feel that there are problems with regular people or amateurs contributing to a dialogue that everyone can hear. Based on some of these criticisms, I couldn't help but ask, are we only collecting this stuff because it's on the web? Creating a Facebook or MySpace page can take less than 5 minutes. YouTube videos may take longer to create, but as mentioned earlier, many of the videos were not original and did not contribute anything significant or unique to describe the impact that Shepard's murder had on society. The websites document that people are remembering Shepard and know about his murder, but does it really say something about the impact or issues surrounding Shepard's death? To answer these questions, one needs to look at Web 2.0 for what it is. Web 2.0 tools allow the end user to quickly and easily contribute content to the World Wide Web for the purpose of basic communication. Although much of the communication appears to be informal, a person who compiles a video or creates a MySpace page has an emotional or cerebral attachment to Shepard's death. It is difficult to appraise this material because content found on Web 2.0 applications doesn't really have a physical counterpart. The websites that allow for this communication have millions of users or potential contributors. With Web 2.0, the archivist can potentially document a networked body of everyday people's thoughts, views, and comments, unlike in the physical world where only a piece of the conversation can often be documented. In my opinion, the content or conversation created by Web 2.0 technology documents the impact Shepard's murder had on a broad range of people in a unique way. Still, I collected a limited amount of this content, even though we had room for 60 more websites at the end of the project. While it was tempting to run another crawl and try to collect the omitted MySpace pages and YouTube videos in order to use all of our prepaid subscription space, I chose not to do this primarily because a selective approach is generally recommended for collecting web resources. Capturing everything can be a headache to manage and access. Moreover, because many of these sites looked similar and held the same information, a sampling of the sites was sufficient. It was also difficult to determine the value of Web 2.0 content because rarely did we have a relationship with the creator. Content collected from the web is in general unauthenticated, and this becomes even more of a concern in a Web 2.0 environment where millions of people can quickly and easily create an account and user profile and upload content. In a recent American Archivist article discussing the authenticity of cell phone-generated records, an interviewee makes a statement that also speaks well to Web 2.0 content. Ultimately, not all videos or Web 2.0 content in the collection can be authenticated. This points to show just how crucial it is for users and contributors to submit sufficient metadata. If we have the date, location, the facts, and context about what we are seeing, and when security is not an issue, who created it, there is a much better chance of verifying or corroborating its authenticity. These Flickr photos provide an example of unverified content, yet also show how Web 2.0 applications can help to authenticate content through metadata found online. This first set of photos is titled ACC Matthew Shepard Service, and it includes 4 photos dated October 14, 2008. They seem to be photos of a 10-year memorial service in New Zealand, but how do we know that what we're looking at is what it purports to be? There isn't any other context around these photos, and I don't know who the creator, Stephen Witherden, is, because I've never heard of or met him. From just this information, we can't be 100% sure that these photos are from an actual 10-year memorial service, yet I trusted it anyway and added it to the collection. Another example, we captured a picture of a vanity license plate reading "End Hate," and when you drag your mouse over it, it states that they were ordered the day that Matthew Shepard died. That shows quite the impact that Shepard's death had on the person, but without knowing the creator and seeing supporting documents, how can we be sure that it's true? Well, the internet is an interesting beast. By Googling these individuals and looking at their user profiles, more information can be found that can lead us to make a somewhat educated decision to trust the photos that they've uploaded. For example, Mr. Witherden is a software developer in New Zealand who is also involved with GLBT issues. Carrie is an elementary teacher who happens to have a lot of other photos dealing with peace and equality. Although this doesn't substitute for a relationship between repository and creator, it does help us trust that we really are seeing a 10-year memorial service in New Zealand and that a lady in Michigan was inspired to get these vanity plates when she heard about Matthew Shepard. Of course, there is always the possibility that either username represents a fabricated individual. One of the biggest issues surrounding Web 2.0 content is copyright. The JISC Digital Curation Manual on Archiving Web Resources states, rights become increasingly complex issues for social websites. Where websites comprise thousands of contributions, each having the rights of its creators, addressing rights issues presents significant challenges. When all of these issues have been addressed, and only then, can full responsibility be taken for material and the necessary steps taken to achieve the goals of long-term viability and access. Intellectual property and copyrights are indeed complex. For the Matthew Shepard Web Archive, we tried to capture content created and therefore copyrighted by someone else, and moreover, hosted on a privately owned third-party site, which often included comments and content posted by yet more people. In beginning to address the issues involved, one first needs to know whose permission is needed. When collecting content from Web 2.0 applications, does one need permission of the website, such as Facebook or Flickr, or just the permission of the creator of the content? To attempt to answer this question, I turn to the site's terms of service agreements, which state who owns the rights to the content. Facebook, MySpace, Flickr, and YouTube all state that the individual contributors, the users, own the content. However, this does not clarify whose permission needs to be sought in order to archive the sites. Because I could not find a clear answer to any of these companies' terms of service agreements, I contacted the companies by email but have not yet received a straight answer from any of them. Flickr responded by saying that if I wanted to use a photo, I needed to contact the creator. Facebook responded by telling me not to proceed with use of any intellectual property until you have received formal approval from us. As with most copyright rules, ambiguity is a problem. With that said, there is documentation that Twitter has clearly expressed that they have no problem with archiving and that permission need only come from the Twitteree. Before I conclude, the last issue I want to briefly touch upon is that many Web 2.0 pages are still active. Traditionally, archivists have stepped in to manage records when they are no longer useful to the creator, when the record is no longer active. In the Web 2.0 world, where web pages and websites can be commented on and new material can be added at the click of a button, these records can potentially be active forever. Because we only crawled for 1 month, the Flickr and MySpace pages that we collected have probably changed slightly. There could be new comments or other content on them that wasn't captured in the original crawl. Although the pages may continue to change once part of the page is captured, this shouldn't stop us from collecting what we can. Like regular websites, Web 2.0 applications are in danger of becoming lost, especially because the companies that own these sites do not have a plan for preserving them. One way to collect this changing record is to crawl a website periodically for a long length of time, and if we had not been bound to a subscription period, then we could have done this. From this case study, it is clear that Web 2.0 content cannot be fully captured at present. Web crawlers and access mechanisms are not yet advanced enough to capture and display the websites as they should be seen. In fact, for some sites, such as Facebook and YouTube, a printed page would have better captured the layout, content, and contextual information. In addition, to overcome the barrier that copyright issues present, the companies hosting the material need to state unambiguous policies about permissions and what can be captured by whom. Fortunately, organizations such as the Living Web Archives, the International Internet Preservation Consortium, and the Joint Information Systems Committee have been working to develop best practices and policies for the acquisition, access, and preservation of Web 2.0 applications. If you're interested in staying up to date with this topic, I recommend following the JISC Power blog. They have an entire section dedicated to archiving Web 2.0 applications, and blog posts are posted quite regularly. As for the American Heritage Center, we are working to develop ways to acquire and preserve born digital materials, including websites. Although the current web archive includes a limited amount of Web 2.0 sites, I believe that this content is valuable material for the collection, and the addition of the sites that we could not capture last October would further document the impact that Matthew Shepard's life had on our world. Thank you.
I have to mention a couple things before we start out. Can you hear me? All right. Thanks to everybody sitting on that side of the room. I've been taking some cold medicine. So if I start coughing or anything like that, I apologize in advance. This is a case study of, on the one hand, just another less than tranquil period in the history of a university. But I'm here this morning because it's a case study of events documented and played out and kept alive through social media, initially, for well over a year and continuing to the present. I'm going to refrain today from going into too much detail about events which transpired on my campus, as at this particular podium, my reason for being here is less about those events and more about the how and why of communication and collection development. I will say that there were days when what was happening on campus made me wish for a simpler workplace, something like a Sears portrait studio with 300 screaming children, not one filled with 300 screaming commenters. What we did at the College of William & Mary is not the Cadillac of collection development or access programs. It's not even a Volkswagen. And while I don't think it's going to turn out like a bankrupt U.S. automaker, I'm not quite sure where we fall yet on that spectrum of car and car maker analogies. But I do hope you get the idea of what I'm trying to say. Okay. The College of William & Mary, just for a little bit of context, is a public liberal arts university of about 7,700 students nestled in bucolic colonial Williamsburg, Virginia. William & Mary is not known for its activism or even necessarily activity. So you get the idea of where I'm coming from. In 2007 and early 2008, just to give you some context of where we were at William & Mary in collecting online content and truly electronic records in general, up to that point, a member of the library's system staff, really more of a digital humanities person, someone, for those of you familiar with it, more of a that camp type of participant, he had on his own initiative gone out and grabbed the wm.edu domain name annually for the previous couple of years, but that was about it. When I arrived in 2007, we talked about Archive It, and we looked into it, and we hoped for it, and we still hope for it someday. Electronic records acquired by Special Collections at that time were saved on the media they came in on, meaning there were, and still are in many cases, records sitting on discs, tapes, etc., of various vintages in the collection, and I'm sure we're all familiar with those. They'd not yet been transferred to other media, let alone migrated or emulated. The department had neither actively sought nor had plans for, really, electronic records of any variety. So just to give you some sense of where I'm coming from. In recent years, though, Special Collections has opened itself to experimentation and new projects with an internal reorganization meant to streamline operations across collecting areas as well as bring the department into the late 20th and, dare we even hope, the early 21st centuries. The department's adopted a collection management system, we use a wiki, and we're using other tools. Okay, the SDRC and the library were also developing a presence in locales such as Flickr, mostly via sharing photos of current events, such as this popular recycled paper art project, which was created by a student in the library. Seen here is the first week of the project, with the librarian standing in for a measuring stick. Images such as these were not initially garnering the rapt attention of current students, but they did prove somewhat popular on library blogs, probably not as popular as the cat videos earlier mentioned, but popular in their own way. A popular use of Facebook for staff like myself was for seeking responses from student workers, and that's a little blurry, but basically asking them, hey, when are you coming back to work? And you know what? They replied when you did that on their wall. It was amazing. The library Special Collections and other units in the library did eventually establish various presences on Facebook and other sites. So a bit of background to events surrounding our collection development and outreach efforts with social media. In 2005, Jean R. Nickel was appointed the 26th president of the College of William & Mary. In October 2006, the policy regarding a brass cross available for the chapel in the historic Sir Christopher Wren building at the College of William & Mary was changed, removing the cross from permanent display on the altar. The cross was from that point forward available at the request of groups or individuals using the chapel for events. This change in policy was, not surprisingly, picked up by the student newspapers on campus, as well as bloggers, both not so well-known and well-known, such as Michelle Malkin, as well as other online news sites. These events began to transpire just in time for the university's annual homecoming weekend. The story of the removal of this brass cross quickly spread via blogs and soon birthed its own blogs, websites, Facebook groups, and on and on. And just to insert myself into the chronology, in November 2006, I visited William & Mary for the first time for my interview for my current position. I had come across the news story during my, you know, the research you're supposed to do when you're interviewing for a new job. So I was aware of it, and it was a fairly new story at the time, obviously. And the topic did come up briefly during my dinner with my soon-to-be future boss and dean. But we talked about it slightly less than we talked about the weather. Part of the thought there is, of course, that, you know, things like politics and religion really don't make for good digestion. When I arrived on campus in February 2007, I began developing a list of blogs and other websites outside of the wm.edu domain name, which we might wish to capture at some point in the future. Most, if not all, of these were related to the continuing controversy related to the cross, as well as other issues that began surrounding the university's president. The initial action, removing a brass cross from permanent display in a public place, did morph to embroil the president and the entire university in ongoing stories on topics related to political persuasion, religion, sexuality and sex, etc., etc. The university archives had for many years benefited from weekly batches of news clippings that I'm sure many archivists in the crowd are familiar with. These were distributed to key offices by university relations. And as I settled in at William & Mary, I noted which of these local and regional newspapers allowed online commenting on their stories and began visiting those comments and selectively grabbing, most often simply by printing those pages of comments, generally several, for retention along with the articles in the archives clipping files. This was done simply because it was the easiest thing to do at the time, and of course we couldn't anticipate what would come later. Basically, it didn't require any intervention from the library or university IT staff. It really didn't require any extra resources beyond some acid-free paper and a copier or printer. We made the decision not to capture comments from the student newspapers because we had established relationship with those publications and their webmasters. We knew their policies were to not delete user comments, whereas the local and regional newspapers, we knew and we had evidence of their deletion of comments that they decided were offensive or that had been marked as offensive by other commenters, or were deleted by the individuals who had left them. Okay. We also followed mentions of the continuing news stories on blog, news media, and especially those not noticed by the university's official clippings person. And this was, of course, all thanks to Google Alerts. In 2007, after I arrived at William & Mary, I joined Facebook, believing strongly, and even still today believing, that we should be where our potential and actual users and donors are, whether that's potluck dinners hosted by community organizations, the coffee shop where flyers are distributed, or Facebook groups, serious and less serious. As much as I might have enjoyed or found some of these groups in an attempt to maintain a semblance of objectivity, I did not join any Facebook groups related to the president or the related controversies. Even though I really wanted to join some of them. For us, Facebook is a communication and research tool to find content creators, and community connections. This was the result of several considerations. Facebook's user agreement, and Laura covered that well, so I won't go there. The various formats and compressions of content that individuals were adding to Facebook, and the, perhaps especially at that time, perception of student users that what they did on Facebook was somehow private or theirs alone or hidden from the rest of us. Keep in mind, this was earlier days of Facebook, when exposés of daughters and sons of public figures being exposed on Facebook and other social networking sites were still relatively new to the news media. And while today, again, it's routine for old media to cite not only blogs, but also Facebook and Twitter. Heard it again on NPR yesterday morning. In 2007, this was certainly less so. One striking episode of how this was brought home to me was fairly early on in my time at William & Mary. I was giving an introductory section to special collections for a class. The very typical, this is what we have, this is how you come, and this is what you use. And I mentioned that we document alumni, faculty, staff, students, anything related to the university, and that we were actively looking for material. And one of the students in the class, who I'd never met, at least that I knew of, interjected, "Oh yeah, I heard you're on Facebook taking our stuff." And after, I'm sure, what was less than an eloquent, I tried to explain that, well, yes, of course, I was on Facebook. I had an account. The library and the department had a presence on Facebook. We were not there systematically taking content from Facebook, either printing or screen captures or anything like that. And the student said, "Oh, okay," and promised to go back and tell his friends that that was what was going on. And this, again, as I said, no matter how much I might have wanted to do that sometimes, that was our policy. And it was certainly absolutely true at the time. Later, obviously, as you can see from my slides, we've gone back and done screen captures of Facebook groups and some content. But more often, this was done and continues to be done for reference purposes, by which I mean ways for us to find and track individuals, content creators, who we can then later go back and contact, either via Facebook or other means. Essentially, as I said, we were contacting those individuals seeking their content for the archives. In addition to browsing Facebook groups for images, videos, posters, etc., we also sought the same from Flickr and YouTube. Primarily, this was done later, kind of jumping ahead the story, after the president's resignation. Almost without exception, we did not contact individuals and organizational creators during the approximately 1.5 years of controversy surrounding the president of the college about material specifically related to the controversies. And this was for a variety of reasons, not the least of which was the desire to avoid having myself, the department, the library, or even the university further drawn into blog or newspaper coverage. There were some past and ongoing donors of materials to the library and to the department who were involved as passionate advocates on several sides of the issues. And we were conscious of not wanting to create any wrinkles in those relationships. Also, frankly, Williamsburg is a small town, which can be made to feel even smaller and more uncomfortable. And of course, there was also the fact that I was quite new to the institution, and without the sort of, frankly, professional protections I'd felt in my previous tenure track, unionized position, it was generally agreed and understood between myself and my my boss that this was the approach we were going to take. When individuals of any camp or viewpoint did come to special collections during this year, 18 months of tribulation, doing research related to the ongoing controversy, we helped them as best we could, as we would anyone else. I believe we did that. I know we did that. When the opportunity or opening presented itself to inquire after content suitable for the archives with individuals or organizations, we did so, but we were especially thoughtful in making those inquiries and mindful of our tone and the scope of the inquiry. Our caution in this documentation was not entirely new to me professionally, and I felt supported during that time in conversations I was having with other archivists during and after, and also felt that this was not unique to my experience with the episode. Some will assert that objectivity is impossible in appraisal and processing. Honestly, upon reflection, it seems to me the question of what is objective cannot be settled. While I regularly assert in correspondence and conversations with donors and potential donors, reports, articles, and other forums, that as an archivist, I'm documenting an event, not a particular point of view, one of the voices in my head cannot stop questioning my objectivity. In a previous position, documenting environmental groups, I regularly made this assertion, that I was documenting the event, not the point of view. But the reality is that I found it, frankly, easier to communicate with a particular type of group or individual over another. I also realized at the time, and certainly more so now with the benefits of distance, time, location, experience, that in the past I've hesitated to contact organizations active in issues on which I felt quite strongly, acknowledging, at least to myself, that my ability to act objectively might be strained. While we generally kept a low profile in collecting related to the cross and later controversies related to the president while he was in office, that does not mean that we were not tracking potential content on and via social media. We certainly had an awareness of the potential transitory nature of some of this content. For instance, in the summer of 2007, a new blog defending the president and his point of view, which also attempted to expose what it saw as some of the problems with those on the other side, other camp, was born and saw active posting and commenting for several weeks. I'd been following the blog on my blog feeds and saving the posts as I often do in my reader for those related to work. Late in the summer, the library attempted to crawl the blog just to go out and do a snapshot to capture its posts and comments, but were somehow denied by creators, by how the creators had configured the blog. There was an informal discussion about contacting the authors of the blog directly, who were students and recent alumni. Before we could do this, however, the blog was taken down and deleted. Now, as hopefully everyone in the room knows, even though you may delete something from the internet, there are, of course, a variety of ways it may not be gone. The most obvious being Google Cache, or in this case, save posts in my feed reader, as well as some I had printed out, and, of course, other means. We went ahead and printed the text of the entries for my reader, and the conversation about that blog and its place in the archives with its creators is ongoing. Just to be clear, until the president's resignation, our documentation was a paper-electronic hybrid, with most of the content being websites, blogs, and comments on news media stories. We found that students were mostly active on Facebook, with some images on Flickr, a very small number. There was much commenting on student newspaper stories and some non-student newspaper stories. Alumni and others who associations with the college were less direct or immediate, were more likely to create websites and new blogs, use existing blogs, their own and others, as well as being quite active in commenting on various news media outlets, whether Melkin, O'Reilly, Wonkette, Jezebel, or another. Our documentation of unofficial records related to the presidency and resignation of Gene Nickel was in a quiet observational phase until his resignation on February 12, 2008, just after 10 a.m. At that time, the email from the president announcing his resignation was received. I was hosting a meeting with staff about their records, archives, and records destruction. Our conversation was interrupted by a director who came in to alert us of the news. The meeting soon thereafter finished. Those of us on Facebook immediately noted the new groups forming, messages being exchanged, and plans for events on campus. We used our existing network, sending an email to current and past student workers, asking them to keep the archives in mind as they saw physical material for the archives in the coming day, as well as online content. This LiveJournal page was immediately sent to me by one of our former student workers. Thank you, Shauna. This message was also then sent on to other library staff with the request that they share it with their student workers. I then began contacting creators of Facebook groups and those we were noticing to be particularly active on Facebook. I first sent the same message via Facebook, send a message, but then Facebook identified me as a spammer. So I changed my message slightly each time and then simply began contacting individuals outside of Facebook via regular old plain email like the other old people use, I was told. That rainy afternoon, I and another archivist joined students, staff, faculty, administrators, and others at a rally in the sunken garden armed with our digital cameras. While there, I greeted the university's wonderfully talented photographer. And somewhat jokingly, I asked him, "Where's your camera?" He looked at me, smiled, and said, "I'm on my lunch break." It was rather late in the afternoon. I'd assumed we would not be able to rely on any of his photographs for the archives in the future, and having it confirmed so early in the course of our response to the president's unexpected resignation was at least helpful to us to plan as best we could. I visited the president's house and photographed material being left on his doorstep and nearby. You'll note the Creative Commons license there. We asked each other as archivists and all of our donors to sign off on a creative license that that they were comfortable with. A Creative Commons license, rather, they were comfortable with. Seen here is a close-up of one letter we photographed and later posted on Flickr, along with other photographs we took that day and in the days following. The author of the letter, Ryan, there later commented and said, "Hey, I'm famous." We commented back to him, and then had a conversation with him outside of Flickr, and he did later send us a text copy of his letter and shared what we were doing with other students, which I can't emphasize enough the importance of doing that. The day of the resignation, upon returning to the office, I and the other archivists who were already on Facebook noticed that new faculty and staff at the university were joining Facebook exponentially and friending us. Events were quickly being disseminated via Facebook. I also discovered that multiple students had posted all or portions of my private messages to them in Facebook groups, and I began receiving images, posters, copies of letters, videos, and offers for a variety of other material from students, alumni, parents, and other folks who we were never quite certain who they were. This flow of material has continued, continues to the present, although much slower, of course. On that day, I also sent my assistant to the University Center, the University Student Union, to take more photographs of what was happening there, I gave him a list of planned events he was supposed to attend for the rest of that week, highlighting flyers and other things he should be scouting for. My assistant, a then recent graduate of an MLS program, asked in the following days, "How did I know about all these things that were going on around campus?" I simply replied, "Facebook." And there he learned that I had not been kidding when I had told him when he was hired that he should join Facebook, because working at a university, or really anywhere, but especially at a university at that time, someone who was working there should have at least an account and a few friends. He soon thereafter joined Facebook. The next day, my boss said to me, "You know, you should really document what you're doing because you could talk about this to a room full of people someday." So I said, "Yes, that would be fabulous. Thank you. And I hope to be sick that day." I said, "Maybe in a year and a half, we'll think about it." So thank you to Tara Laver for organizing the session. Tara, if you're in the room, thanks. I realize more now so in retrospect that my documentation actions in the immediate aftermath of the president's sudden resignation were influenced in no small part by the stories I heard as a little pre-archivist at the University of Wisconsin about the lone, and maybe it's actually probably not the lone, but the brave archivists who were going out in the 50s and 60s and 70s regularly collecting flyers and posters from across campus. I think we had aspirations of that. We found partners in collecting content in groups and loose associations that had formed within the university community outside of the established Flickr, YouTube, etc. We did have issues there with some individuals who wished to not only remain anonymous, but were reluctant to attach a Creative Commons license to their images, videos, etc., or to outright transfer copyright. Our first preference throughout was that the individuals attach a Creative Commons license. This was an experiment for us. We thought this was a great opportunity to try that approach with donors. Most of them, once they understood what it was, were very enthusiastic about it. We continue to work with individuals and organizations from various camps on these matters. I've met a number of people who I'd previously only known virtually, both intentionally and serendipitously, since events of a year and a half ago. We remain optimistic about material continuing to flow to the archives related to the president's resignation and the university in general. Some of these online communities, including not only blogs, but also Google groups and other associations, have come and gone in the space of the first year since the resignation. Now, just a few words about access and storage to kind of tie up here. We immediately saved the images and videos staff shot in the days and weeks after the president's resignation, first to the library's secure storage server, and then uploading them to Flickr and YouTube where applicable. We did not immediately make those images and videos visible on Flickr and YouTube. When we did turn them on for public view a few months later, we included the note seen here about seeking additional material for the archives. This was included in the Flickr set and the YouTube playlist, as well as some of the individual items. Why Flickr and YouTube? Initially, they were our only publicly accessible options for sharing the content we had created ourselves and that we had gathered with the public. I'll also note that there was no appraisal at the time of ingesting of the images and videos from students, alumni, and others, as seen here. All were loaded as if with minimal description, tagging, and attribution from our staff. But you can see here, this did result in an occasional amused comment from some of the contributors. Engagement in any form, we like it, we'll take it. By the summer of 2008, our installation of DSpace was up and mostly running. All of the images and videos we had created and collected were eventually loaded into their now long-term home. This year, we've made the move to... that's the DSpace record there. Here we go. This year, we've made the move to using the digital library function in Archon. Here's the record, the brief finding aid record for the president's resignation response collection. And the little green arrow there indicates there's digital content. We need to clean that up. But there is a note here at the bottom, show digital links. And here are links to the content. We've not loaded the content directly into Archon. We have a link from our Archon database back to DSpace. And this is for IT and technical reasons. That is really an entire three different sessions. And basically, we know it's not perfect, but it's working right now and accomplishing our goals, one of our goals, which are to ensure the preservation of the material and make it available. We've not yet added any text documents we've received, the many text documents we received, to any of the digital archives. This is really, at this point, a matter of staffing and oversight on our part, as the collection of videos, images, correspondence, press, artifacts, and other materials has not been fully arranged and described at present. What you see here, is just the brief record. To date, we've received and or gathered several cubic feet of material, about 3.5 gigabytes of digital material, encompassing over 300 files of photos, videos, images, posters, text. We've done, as I mentioned, we are not using Archive-It, even though we had hoped to. We've simply gone out and captured about over a gigabyte and a half of website captures, including static websites and blogs. Again, that's to date. That is an ongoing effort for us. We also recognize that we've documented not only a period of upheaval in the university's history. It's not the first, and it certainly won't be the last. We are also documenting a communications and popular culture in time. For instance, the Facebook group referencing the world of Harry Potter as compared to the university, it has further context when one realizes that there is a Harry Potter group at the university called Wizards and Muggles that's very active and a portion of whose records are already in the archives. We expect that material will continue to trickle into the archives with a shift from current students and alumni to faculty and staff who may be moving offices, retiring, getting new computers, etc. Just to wrap up, from here, Special Collections moves forward with assessment and review of not only using social media for collection development, but truly our collection development more broadly. We have no benchmarks by which to judge what is an effective effort in collecting for the department. We know we want Archive-It or something else. but beyond that, we don't really know. We know that we were able to reach a wider audience exponentially faster, not only via email, but via Facebook, Flickr, and YouTube, as well as making that content quickly available to the public. It remains for us to tackle issues of appraisal, to what degree or even if. We know we had to collect this material, and the weight of other considerations remains to be seen. The level of culture promoted is yet to be determined, but we are certain that a public service was provided. Thank you.
Okay, we have time for some questions. Could you go to the microphone, please?
I'm not clear with the University of Wyoming case. Did you actually make, say, a video from YouTube available, or are you just giving pointers on your site?
We captured other people's YouTube videos.
And then did you make the effort to contact the person who made the video?
Oh, no, we did not. We did not contact any of the creators of any of the websites. We kind of did what the Internet Archive does, which was to respect robots files that are embedded in websites that block crawlers. If there wasn't a blocker, then we went ahead and captured it. And if a creator of any of the content that we archived asks us to take a site down, then archive it. We'll work with them to most likely get rid of the link to that site and also to install or embed that robot blocker on their website.
Okay, thank you.
By contrast, and I think it's partially because of the size of our university and also our outlook on things and what the library is trying and the department is trying to do, we went with that personal contact. We were using Flickr and YouTube and Facebook to find individuals and organizations, and then we were contacting them directly, requesting the master files for those content. Also realizing that the 9-minute and 58-second video that's on YouTube is not everything they were shooting. And yes, we've got some fuzzy images and some video that's a lot of black and a little dots of white, but there's some great content in there. So it was, we were able to do that also because of the scale of just the institution and our potential, our donor base.
Hi, I'd be, is this working?
Sort of.
I'd be interested in the panel's comments on a scenario of, if I could share really briefly, about a collection that was discovered and publicized through Web 2.0. And this was a small collection at a repository that had been closed for 10 years from a U.S. Army veteran who was in Japan after World War II and claimed he had pictures of the aftermath of Hiroshima. And a history professor had discovered them once the collection was open, publicized it on his blog prior to publishing a book based on these resources, and once it got out into the blogosphere, it was found out that these photos were not of Hiroshima. And instead, they were of another event in Japan, of an earthquake instead. And it really had a lot of backlash on our archive because a journalist in France writing for Le Monde got a hold of the story and really kind of blew it out of proportions so that it wasn't merely a cataloging mistake, but it was an intentional misrepresentation on our part of the contents of this collection. And I'll just tell you that in the past year, I've met about 4 or 5 different archivists from France and Switzerland who have told me they saw that Le Monde story. So I don't know if it's a cautionary tale of what can happen to our collections when they hit Web 2.0, even without our participation. I'd be interested in your comments.
I feel for you, and I think things like that happening, that idea that something like that could happen to a repository, certainly guided how we reacted to the event and documenting what happened. That caution. I think this is it's a great learning opportunity for all of us about when a news story breaks. It's an outreach opportunity for us to get out there and move the story from, this was an intentional thing to, oops, it was a mistake, but this is a great resource we have. And this is, this is an opportunity for other people to provide input and correct the mistakes we've made, and we're open to that. But, PR nightmare. Oh, someone needs to buy you lunch every day. Yeah.
I have a question for Amy Schindler. I don't know if this is working. Have you been able to leverage any of the APIs, especially from Flickr, to generate metadata for your images?
We have, the question was if we've been able to leverage any APIs from Flickr or other sources to generate metadata, gather metadata. The answer is no. We are a small institution. We have been without appropriate IT support for quite some time. That's a lame excuse. I realize that, but it's the reality of the situation we were living in at that time and continue to live with at present. So, no, we haven't. We'd love to. We really should be. It's on my to-do list now. Thank you.
Hi. Ms. Schindler, you mentioned using Creative Commons as a way to sort of get permission from the different contributors to use their content. And I was wondering if that was a sort of an efficient way to get around some of the copyright issues that Ms. Jackson sort of was confronted with the Matthew Shepard materials. I don't know, can you use it for things like Facebook and some of the other ones where the, I guess the rules are more opaque?
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, we adopted the Creative Commons idea for the content. We saw this as an opportunity to do that. Previously, it was give us all of your copyright. But because a lot of this content was, immediately being loaded to Flickr and YouTube and Facebook and other places, we didn't want to have to say, okay, we know you've got it on Flickr, but you're giving it to us, we're taking all the copyright, because, any savvy person realizes what that could mean, and we wouldn't, force them to take it down, but, if they gave us copyright, we would have the right to do that. So we saw this as a great opportunity to experiment. With adopting Creative Commons licenses with active new content. And as far as the content that's in Facebook, as I said, we were going into Facebook finding content students had loaded there onto their individual profiles or groups or what have you, and saying, we found this, we'd love to have it, can you give it to us outside of Facebook, and here's a Creative Commons agreement. So.
Any other questions? Well, it's about that time, so please join me in thanking our speakers.